Hi.
How are you? My name is Andy Stefik. While I'm here, just call me Stefik. That's what everybody calls me. Like, I know different countries have different traditions, like what you say, like professor or whatever title, but just call me Stefik. It's just fine. I am an expert in a number of computer science-y areas, but one of the ones that Auntie Honey invited me to talk about while I was here was how humans use programming languages or how people invent things effectively, right? And I'm guessing the fact that you're sitting here is you're interested in that. Is that correct? Is there anyone that sounds really dumb? Because, you know, that's what we're going to talk about. So if so, then, you know, you might have chosen the wrong class, right? But I also do a lot of work for accessibility. So we invent a lot of technologies for people with disabilities. Especially, I do a lot of work for the blind population. Right now, I've been inventing a way to do 3D graphics and manipulate that while you're blind, which is a long story that for another day. So in any case, so over the next week, what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of do some interactive discussions and partial lectures. If you aren't aware of the academic literature, just sitting and blabbing to you is actually not a very effective way to get information into your heads. And so interactivity, or as they say, active learning, is much more effective. So I tend to follow that kind of approach. So most of the quote-unquote lectures will be interactive. But what we're going to be talking about is sort of like how programming language design is sort of done today. But it's going to be completely different than what you might have looked at in a course, right? Like, how many of you just, by show of hands, have taken a programming language course of some kind? Okay, and so what kind of stuff did one of you do in that course? So maybe you in the corner in the green jacket, what did you do in your programming languages course?
We studied principles of the language.
Right, like what? Can anyone name one? Maybe syntax, right? That's pretty common to talk about. Like, did any of you talk about abstract syntax trees or parse trees or parsers or lexers? Yeah. Okay. Well, in any case, those are common topics. But those are more in the range of the mathematics behind programming languages, all very important. However, this is not that. This is the impact of programming languages, right? How does it impact people? And there's a number of problems in the field of programming languages that remain unsolved, that are very serious problems. And the reason that they're serious, as you'll come to hear, is because they're really, really expensive problems. And one of the ways that we can solve some of them as researchers or scholars is we can try to use a technique called empiricism, which we'll talk about. And so I'm going to give you some information about the history of how we solved big problems in other fields and what people are trying to do today to try to make progress on some of this stuff. But before we do that, I would like to, if it's okay with all of you, and I can stop the recording if you prefer for a few minutes, but you know, it doesn't matter to me. I don't really care. What I'd like to do is just kind of go around the room, figure out who all of you are, and figure out where are you from, why did you decide to take the course, and like what did you hope to get out of it? And the reason for that is because I want to be able to tailor things and adjust it as we go over the week in case there's something you really want to know about, right, related to this area. In other words, I'm only here for a week, so let's make the best of it, of what we have, right? Does that make sense? You're all so quiet. I know it's Monday. I'm the one with jet lag, I swear. Okay. All right, so let's just go around, and I'll start with Auntie Honey, just because you're here for a reason too. So why don't you say who you are and stuff?
Yeah, I'm a university teacher here. Every course here has a course coordinator who is works with the invite, and is running around helping get this done. And my background is in programming languages, and it's very interesting. While I know your stuff, I'm still really, really, I think I will learn a lot by sitting here. And
I'm a student here in university, and I want this course because Antti Lani recommended it, and it sounded interesting.
Okay. What do you hope to get out of it? Is there anything in particular you hope to get out of it? And if there isn't, you're just interested, that's okay. You can just say that.
Maybe I'm just interested. I studied some psychology minor studies, and it sounded that it might be somehow connected.
You'll see, yeah.
Hello, everyone. I'm Yena. I'm from Russia, from Moscow. Yes, I'm a sociologist, and I need to do empirical researches, and I also need to always need to improve my statistical knowledge, skills, and particularly in R program. I studied R program by myself, so I need always to differentiate in this knowledge and use it in my researches, at my job and at my own project.
Okay, thank you.
I'm also from Russia, but same from St. Petersburg. My name is Luba. I decided to take this course because I'm studying and working in the area of computer science and mathematics, and I see this course as maybe soft skills, and because of I do some scientific research work, I need to know how to make an experiment.
Okay, great.
Hi, my name is Vilma. I study here in the West Collective. I took this course because I'm interested in the topic, and also I'd like to incorporate it into my master's thesis. And I hope to learn new things and maybe learn how to do research in this area.
Okay, great.
Hey, my name is Dmitry, and I'm originally from St. Petersburg, but now I'm finishing my PhD in the University of Eastern Finland, and the main focus is soil ecology, so I'm not a programming expert as close to that, but I'm doing quite a lot of scientific programming, whatever, so data manipulation, and before I was as well, got some background in mathematical methods in economy, so...
We actually just published a paper on scientific computing languages, and so I've put it in there in the link. We'll go over some stuff. So
okay.
It might be of interest to you. So.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, hi, I'm Mahinde. I'm from Lapland. I'm PhD student in Lapland Institute of Technology. My major business analytics, including machine learning and passive technology. So I just do this course content. So I want to do the sampling for the methods and so on. So that's why I choose.
Okay.
Hey, my name is Rami. I study here in UNESCO. Well, Antti Vani recommended this course this spring, so that's why I'm here, basically. So I want to learn more about designing and researching programming languages, and, well, it's possible if I also write my master's thesis from this topic.
Great.
Hi, my name is Sandra Reisman, and I'm studying here in Jyväskylä. And this course just sounded interesting, and I want to learn the human side in programming language.
Okay, great.
So I'm Elina Pollari. I'm studying my master's here. And actually, I took this course because, of course, I wanted to develop myself in programming, but then also search the human impact on everything, on computing and stuff, so that makes this culture interesting.
Hi, I'm Edith Nava. I'm also a local student doing my master's. Well, close seems to fit with what I'm studying, so, and I like the summer school, so it's good to get new perspectives on things.
Okay, great, welcome.
Hi, I'm Paula. I'm here. I'm here because something I recommended this course.
Good for you. And I think one person came in.
Yeah, I am Ahmed from Egypt.
Uh-huh.
I Poland. I don't have a clear vision why I will take this course, but since I'm doing scientific programming, I think it will broaden my vision.
Okay, great.
Gain something new. For sure, it will affect my strategy for future programming. This is all my expectation.
Okay, great. And there was one person, what was your name again?
Elena Pola.
For some reason, she wasn't on the list, but I had her just
add
her name.
That's probably my mistake, because I pressed this, I'm going to participate, but a bit too late, because I haven't been using computer for a week, so. But I
just
added her name on the list, so.
And for you, there's a sign-up sheet, so.
Yeah, I've already
done. Oh, you already got it. Okay, great. Okay, so, good. It sounds like you're all here for a reason, one or the other. Sometimes him, sometimes other reasons. So, and so anything that we're going to do, since there's two sort of periods a day, if you will, they're like an hour and a half-ish each. I've heard there's some sort of weird traditions about 15-minute periods that you kind of ignore when and stuff like that, which is kind of funny. Whereas in Vegas, we're always just drunk, so that's just a different tradition. Wearing costumes. None of that's true. In any case, there's two parts that I set up for each of these things. One of them is we're going to do kind of like a theory-ish type thing where we talk about stuff that is known in the either academic literature, like facts, right? So that we kind of have like a shared understanding of what's happening in language design like today, right? Not like 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And a lot of it's intended to be historical, right? I want to bring you up through the last like 300 years of knowledge about a lot of this stuff in, you know, 5 days, right? So good luck, right? But nonetheless, I want to give you enough of an overview that you can go look up stuff and you know what to look up, right? And what to read about as you're going. And then there's going to be some practice stuff. And the purpose of this, I'm glad I added this in because it'll fit well with a lot of you that have like master's thesis that you're talking about. We're going to actually be building experiments as a team and trying to come up with things that you can explore. And so when we do those, tailor it to the stuff you care about because that's the purpose. That's intended to be sort of like a project that you will kind of turn in-ish. We're not really going to grade it. We're just going to kind of like, we want you to turn in something so we have kind of a record of what it is that you did while you were here and we can prove that you get credit for it, basically. But they're kind of, it's intended to be interactively creating these as kind of a team, right? We're all on the same team. That's really the idea. Does that make sense? Okay. But the one thing we won't have is I'm not going to give you like lots of like R practice problems where you go and you rote do it. That's not really the purpose of the course. You can kind of do that on your own. You can like download a textbook or buy one or something and then do all the practice problems. But my goal is to kind of give you an overview of like what the purpose is behind all that stuff and give you a sense, a broader view of what it all means and how it's put together. So, okay, so here's the first thing to think about when you want to know why it matters we have to think about programming language design other than from the perspective of just math. And the reason is it costs cash. Okay? So this is the first reason I want to make this abundantly clear. Paying developers is extremely expensive. Minor changes to programming languages, whether it be for scientific computing or other areas, costs money. It's the primary reason why a lot of us in the language design space actually care about not just the human factor's impact or making it easy to use. Making something easy to use is very expensive for companies, teachers, people like that. So let's kind of start breaking this down. So how many of you are familiar with this Alan Turing bloke? By show of hands. All right, if you're not, Turing was like this guy that had kind of an unfortunate life for lots of reasons that are really not important for the moment. He's also super famous because of all the stuff he did during World War II and many other things is what we now call Turing completeness and all sorts of stuff. But one of the things that kind of stuck with Turing was this idea of machines, right? So can anyone please describe to me what we now call a Turing machine? In your own words, a sentence or two. And if you get it wrong, don't sweat it. What is a Turing machine? Don't all speak at once. And just so you know, because these are interactive sessions, if no one volunteers, someone gets volunteered.
Generally speaking.
Yeah, so tell me generally speaking.
It was in a project for Enigma to break the German.
No. But I appreciate you trying. That was one thing that Turing did that was important, but that's not the Turing machine concept. Yeah. Someone else? Yeah. Yeah, you're talking about the mechanics of a Turing machine. And that's correct. That's true. But what the hell is it? Like, what is the stupid thing? What is it for?
Some kind of huge calculator.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, Turing wanted a way to have a mechanical or other thing do work for him. Right? That's really what it is. And he devised a mathematical system around it, and the way you described it is actually quite correct. He devised a mathematical system around it that allows that computation to happen. And there's all sorts of important stuff about this that I'm not going to talk about. You know, it's like universal computation, universal computing, there's like the limits of computation, the halting problem, and all sorts of really important cool stuff. None of which is important for this particular class, even though it is important. But here's the thing. While Turing did a really good job of figuring out sort of like the mathematical limits of computation and what we can solve with these problems, what he did not do is figure out a way to sort of tell the computer what to do that was universal, so to speak. Right? Like, he came up with a way to do the computations, he described it, but the way he described it was esoteric and weird. And nobody in their right mind would actually do it that way today because it's slow, it's clunky, it's hard to understand, there's all sorts of stuff. And so what ended up happening was that there ended up being this sort of entire industry of products, if you will, that kind of sprang out of the ground to do the kinds of things these Turing machines did. It's the same thing mathematically, but that doesn't matter because you do it differently and these things are incompatible. So for example, take a look at this screen and please tell me which one looks the easiest to represent the idea of hello world. By show of hands, would it be the binary one? By show of hands, would it be the assembly one? By show of hands, how would it be Java? And the last one. Yeah, now, what is it about these that makes it hard or easy? Just intuitively, to you. There is actually evidence on these issues. You don't have to guess, but what do you think makes it intuitive or easy? Shorter's better, possibly. What else? Yeah?
It resembles human language more.
Aha! Somehow it's related to human language, possibly. Good. What else?
You don't need a lot of space for writing.
Okay, maybe you don't need as much space. Okay, what about what makes it harder? Can you think of anything? Yeah.
The computer doesn't understand this output hello world.
Well, no, for the human. What makes it harder to use for a human? Say what?
Machinery code, binary code.
But why? Why is it harder?
Because we don't see what's inside this code, this binary code.
just seeing the numbers.
That's true, but why is that harder?
We can't decode it.
Okay. There somehow has to be a mapping between the numbers and what it does, right?
Have to do by machine.
Right, a machine needs to do that. Is there anything else about these that makes them harder or easier? What do you think? In the back.
I think it's because of the encode-decode machine-based computation power.
Okay. Yeah, so if you are a novice or even a professional and you're switching languages, do you know what static means? How many people, by show of hands, know what that means? How many people don't know what that means? How many people didn't raise their hand because they don't want to admit either way? Well, that one happens to be Java, but actually it's different in other languages.
Mm-hmm.
What static means actually varies. What about this? How many people know what that means? How many people don't know what that means? Right. If you didn't raise your hand, you're lying. I have no idea what that means, right? What about bra printf? Anybody know what that means? Right. You see? So different languages sprang up. There was no even though Turing machines were universal in terms of what they compute, there was no sort of standard. Good morning. There was no sort of standard way to notate what it is that these things did, and computer scientists just kind of made it all up. Right? I was at a talk with Brian Kernighan a few years back, and someone in the audience, it wasn't me, happened to ask him like how he came up with the syntax for C. And I swear what he said was, we kind of just chose it randomly. Right? And when you think about it, to a degree, that's not a criticism. That's just, it was the 60s, he was probably high. Well, no, I have no idea. But it was early days in computer science, and it wasn't necessarily the case that they knew what the right way to represent these things were. Nor could they have possibly known what the impact of a particular language would be or how well it would be used over time. Do you get the idea, though? These do the same thing. There's nothing interesting mathematically about any of these. They do the same thing, but they're just represented differently. And the code is incompatible, right? So how many of you have heard of visual programming languages, by show of hands? Okay, can anyone name one, other than the one on the slide?
I didn't raise my hand.
I know, but that's okay. Give it a shot. Okay. What do you think? Can you think of one?
I'm actually familiar with that one.
Ah, I see. So you're cheating. No, I'm just kidding. Scratch. Perfect. There's one. Can you think of another? There's a ton of these. Scratch, Alice, Pencil Code. There's a ton of them. In any case, the point is they all kind of work similarly. Code.org, AppLab is theirs. And they all work basically the same way. Instead of typing code, it shows up as a visual representation, and then you drag and drop the code from left to right. Right? How many people think that that sounds easier? Again, if you're wrong, there's no penalty, right? How many people think that sounds easier? Okay, what would make that potentially easier? And note that there is actually evidence on this, too. What do you think? You raised your hand. You waved.
It's more visual. You can easily see fast what happens where. You don't need read by line by line. But I think it's a little bit limiting, maybe.
Okay. That's interesting. It might be limiting, but might be easier. What else might make this easier than text-based programming? Plausibly. Again, right now we're just speculating.
You don't need to remember it, and so you need to put a button and you can see this connection.
Yeah, they connect or they don't connect,
yes,
so that you know what is connected or not. That makes sense. Well, the other thing too, when you have code like this right here, you almost have a cheat sheet of like what commands are available, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can see immediately that those are the commands. On the other hand, just because something visual, does that mean that it's easier to use for all people? For example, what if you're blind? Does that mean it's easier to use? Or what if you have a motor disability? Cerebral palsy, you're missing one arm, like a friend of mine in Colorado. What if you had like three fingers, you can't drag and drop easily? There are many different kinds of people across the United States. What if you're deaf? What if you have learning disabilities? There's all sorts of different kinds of human beings. Does being visual benefit all of them in the same way? Okay, what about if you're a professional or if you're young, like child age or like, let's say, 40 or 50? Is the effect the same, you think? If you're a professional and you already know how to code, does the visual part help you? Maybe not, right? What if you're like 6 years old? Does it help you more or less? Hard to say, right? Like you can't read, probably. Maybe 5 or 6, maybe you can a little bit, but not at a very high level. So all of a sudden, the impact becomes unclear because we have to remember ease of use asks the question, for whom, right? And that has to be codified in a rigorous way. In addition, as it turns out, this particular language, Pencil Code, they made all sorts of language design decisions. And some of them are actually known in the literature to cause negative impacts. For example, many of the word choices that they use have shortened words, like FD. And in this case, FD, what do you think it means? It's actually kind of hard to guess. Food? Okay. Forward, but forward of what? Okay, so what this actually means, and I didn't put it on the slide on purpose, it means there's a turtle in the middle of the screen, literally a turtle, and that FD means the turtle should go up, or in the direction it's pointing. Why a turtle? Because historical reasons related to this guy from the 50s and 60s that aren't important. And in addition, this word for, if you take surveys with people that are learning computer programming, what do novices think that the word for means? What would you guess? By the way, novices only in English. I haven't seen it tested with people from Finland or other countries, but I know that it varies because there's a study by somebody else. But take a guess. English-speaking young people around 20 years old, what do they think the word for means? Yeah?
For to do something.
Ah, okay, that's a guess. What else?
Loop,
you might think that, yeah. Okay, they actually think it means the number 4. Right? Just somebody like misspelled it. What is the concept that they're trying to get at, the language designer here? What does this actually do? It loops, so what words might better represent that? Take a guess. If you had to guess of all the words in English, now this is always a question I ask people, but it's funny because like you are all non-native English speakers, and so I have no idea what your responses will be to this, but like what word would you guess in English represents the concept of doing something over and over again?
A loop.
A loop, and what was that?
Repeat.
And as it turns out, if you measure this statistically, the word repeat comes out on top. Why is that? Because it represents the concept of iteration. And it turns out if you have novices actually do tasks related to looping, that single word choice right here, regardless of whether it's visual or not, triples a novice's comprehension. Triple. One word change. Tiny change to a programming language. Worthless change. Trivial. Easy. Means nothing. Triple. In actual measurements. And it turns out that that effect, that tripling effect, persists across multiple scholars measuring it in different ways, measuring it on different kinds of people and at different ages. it appears to be a lot more robust than any of us ever imagined it would be. Weird, right? You would think, we got to change the whole paradigm. Nope. You got to think real carefully about all the details. Okay. All right, so one of the things that we're going to do as we go is we're going to go into some group discussions. And while I want it to be interactive, there are other parts where I want us all to have talk to each other about some of the issues that we're doing as we go. Now, I want to set some ground rules for it first. Number one, and these are kind of obvious, but I just want to set them so that we all kind of are on the same page. Number one, be polite to each other. Right? So, like, if you have an opinion that you think really sucks for some reason, find a way to disagree without insulting each other. Right? I've never actually had students sit there and snipe at each other before, but I always say that first just because we're on the same team. Right? Like, we're not trying to be jerks. We're just trying to have a discussion and sort out the issues. And then, number two, it's okay to disagree with each other. However, your disagreement must be based on facts, right? Not opinions. You can guess, but try to base it on things that are measurable or believable or that you have some evidence for or that you think might work out. Does that make sense? So be nice and try to make your opinions fact-based. Right, those are the two things. Okay, so here's the first question I want you to take a tackle at for 5 minutes or so. Computer scientists have created many different programming languages that do the same thing. Why have we done that? And what is the impact of that decision on society as a whole, meaning across the globe? So to do this, what I want you to do is to find either a group of two people or three people, and I want you to take 3 minutes. I looked at my fake watch. Find people next to you, two or three, depending on if we have an even or odd number of people, and you can participate too. I want you to think about, why have we done that, and what is the impact of that decision? Okay, so 3 minutes, go. And I will time it. Okay, 3 minutes. Say what? Yeah, we can do that after.
No.
Makes sense. She came in late, so. Oh, really? Oh, nice. Yeah, that's okay. Okay, 1.5 minutes left.
I mean, just keep stopping.
Okay, I hear the conversation's dying down, so we'll stop a few seconds early. Okay, so I want to do a call out for each of the groups and one sentence. That's all you get. So you need an individual from each of your teams. You don't have to be the same person every time. To say, first, why do you think that we did that as a society? Why did we build all these computing projects? What did your group think?
We thought a lot of things. My point was that the language might be ugly. It might look ugly. Sometimes things. And we do it to save time.
Okay, that's interesting. What did your group think?
Many different kind of programming languages because there were people that took one thing from the mathematics and the other people that take other thing and they just go different ways because there was no universal programming language thing. So everyone just did their own thing that felt right for them. And because there is many different programming languages nowadays, so there is difficulties with matching them together.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That makes sense. So what about, what do you think that the impact was? So I want to do the other three groups. So what did your group think? What do you think the impact of that sort of dispersion of languages is? And I'm not necessarily looking for anything specific. It could be good. It could be bad. You might have all sorts of reasons. So what do you think?
Impact. So we thought of this division happened came from these people, group of people were trying to accomplish. And then also companies use their own to make it, I don't know how to explain exactly, but...
Okay, that's all right. What did you think for the impact question? Okay. And lastly, your group. What did you think about that impact question?
Well, basically, we thought it makes life more complex for programmers and more expensive for companies, for example, because the different people have learned different languages, and then if they, for example, want to work on a project together, they have to, some of the team has to learn a new programming language, and so programmers in general always have to be learning more and more new languages, and so that makes life more complex and harder.
Yeah, okay, interesting. Okay, so do you kind of get an idea of the kind of format that we want to do when we do these little group discussions? They're all short. They're not intended to be long discussions. And were you all, by show of hands, nice to each other? The rest of you were mean, right? Is that right? Okay. And did you at least try to use facts in your discussion? Right, by show of hands. Seriously, you're all just like, no, you're bullshit, man. Okay, good. I mean, I know that, like, we're still learning what the facts are, so that's okay. But, like, my point is just, let's be scientists. We're wearing our scientist hat right now, right?
I have one question.
Yeah, please.
What is the difference between fact and argument?
Ah, okay. So that's a good question, and a philosophical one. And Auntie Yohani will inevitably yell at me for any answer I give right now. But in this particular case, what I'm saying is not to try to distinguish between the two. What I'm trying to say is that don't just guess. Try to think about, like, things that you can measure, things that you can look at objectively and use that, as opposed to just saying, I like language X and it's great. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Okay, now, we've talked about this idea that developing software is very expensive, so I want to quantify this. Now, I only have data for the United States, and there's a couple reasons for this. One is I can't find it for all the countries. Number two, I don't have time to find it for all countries. We have looked a little bit for data in Germany, but not really found stuff we find all that reliable. It's possible that they have other data for Finland, but I have no idea. It would be interesting, as part of a master's thesis, if you're interested in this sort of thing, to try to find data for other countries in Europe, because it's possible that you might be able to. In any case, in the United States, there's an agency called the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And what it does is what the name implies. It looks for data about employment. Make sense? That's what the Bureau of Labor Statistics does. It's heavily cited by the National Science Foundation and other agencies because it's generally reliable. No data on employment is perfect. No data on employment is perfect. However, it's a hell of a lot better than guessing, because they're very rigorous and they try to be complete. Does that make sense? These are facts. They're imperfect, but they're facts. Okay? In Bureau of Labor Statistics data, it breaks down professions by how many of the people that there are and also how much they get paid in the median. Right? And it turns out that the amount of money that software developers get paid is quite a lot. So at least in the United States, the median wage is $102,000, and there's about 1.1 million of these people across the U.S. That's not a lot compared to the population, but that's still a lot if you're talking about money, right? And if we look at only this group, just that one, that ends up being about $114 billion a year, right? A considerable amount of cash. However, there's a lot of other people that go around software engineering that get paid different amounts. And so that would be things like computer and information research scientists, which are somehow different. I don't know exactly why, but they are. Computer information systems managers, hardware engineers, network architects, computer programmers are different than software engineers in BLS data. Why? Who cares? It doesn't matter. They have a technical distinction that they make between the two. And they make different amounts of money, et cetera, et cetera. If you take all of those people into account, any of them that when we've dug through BLS data, any of them that we think are reasonable in terms of these people might be doing some kind of programming, that ends up being $331.7 billion a year. So how many people would describe that as chump change?
As what?
Oh, right, that wouldn't make sense. Chump, okay, fine. Chump change means a non-significant amount of money. How many people would say that's a significant amount of money? $331.7 billion is a massive amount of cash, right? We would all agree with this. That is a massive amount of cash. If you break this up in other ways and look at how companies define this, some of them do disagree with the exact number. Gartner, this company, says that it's actually around $400 billion of what the industry is. Other estimates can be done different ways. But regardless, it's in the hundreds of billions of dollars that we pay software engineers. Minor differences in their productivity is in the billions, if they exist, which we haven't established yet, whether that's true. Are you with me? Okay. Now, that's just in professional practice. Now, I don't know if it's true in Finland, so I will ask this question. But in the United States as well, we have something that we call our K-12 education system, and what that means is children from the ages of like 5 through about 18, right? Kids in that range. And in the U.S., we have a very serious shortage of software engineers. So we're trying to push computer science to lower ages to try to get more kids into computer science and software engineering. It's happening all over the world, but in the U.S. it's commonplace. And as it turns out, that's really expensive too. Now, why is that? Well, first of all, the National Science Foundation, our agency for science, is spending hundreds of millions of dollars to try to do this, to train people in computer science. And states as well are putting in quite a bit of money. The Obama administration previously said that they wanted to put in $4 billion, but Congress didn't do it. The Trump administration, if I recall correctly, has put in approximately $1 billion to the Department of Education, also a very significant amount of capital. And in Nevada, which is where I live in Las Vegas, Our legislature put in about $2 million a couple years ago, and they just put in another $1.5 million, so we're talking $3.5 million. Now, obviously, $3.5 million is not nearly $331.7 billion, but still, we're talking about dollar investments in the billions for computer science education at a young age. And these numbers also don't take into account the fact that any teacher teaching this has to be trained, which means that has to go through the education system, through the university system, through certification systems, legal systems, and all sorts of stuff like that. By any standard, this is a gross underestimate of the amount it costs to train software engineers, which is a legitimate cost, especially when you realize the moment that you train people in computer science on a particular programming language, those skills don't apply the next time a new language comes out, unless everything transfers, which we don't know yet. We've actually measured this, but the result's not out yet. I'll show you what it is, though. I'll give you a hint, it's not good. Now, as well, although it's expensive to do stuff, software, building software has value, which is the only reason we bothered to do it in the first place. You go to the airport and they can lose your luggage and have the computer track where it was lost, if you're lucky. And so I want to give you an example. There's a tool called FindBugs. By show of hands, how many people have heard of FindBugs? How many people have not heard of FindBugs? Okay. FindBugs is a program that is where the authors claim it can find bugs. I know the name is very, you know, presumptuous. And I want you to read this really quick, and I'll read it out loud. FindBugs uses static analysis to inspect Java bytecode for occurrences of bug patterns. Static analysis means that FindBugs can find bugs by simply inspecting a program's code. Executing the program is not necessary. This makes FindBugs very easy to use. In general, you should be able to use it to look for bugs in your code within a few minutes of downloading it. FindBugs works by analyzing Java bytecode, compiled class files, so you don't even need the program's source code to use it. Because its analysis is sometimes imprecise, this is a key sentence, FindBugs can report false warnings, which are warnings that do not indicate real errors. In practice, the rate of false warnings reported by FindBugs is less than 50%. Okay, now, you might say, why are you picking on this product? This product's been published for decades. I mean, not decades, a long time in the software engineering things. So if you go and you publish at major journals and conferences, you will have heard of FindBugs. It's been published on for a very long time. People have made their careers on FindBugs. However, they also make a lot of claims here, right? Very specific, in theory, testable claims. Here's a few. FindBugs finds real bugs more than 50% of the time. That's a claim made by the authors. So just by show of hands, how many people believe that? That you can take a program, an arbitrary program, and it finds real bugs 50% of the time? Show of hands. How many people are skeptical of that claim? Okay. One is that FindBugs has false positives. That it reads source code, it claims. How many people believe that claim? Yeah. How many people are skeptical of that claim? Okay. And FindBugs is easy to use. How many people believe that claim? How many people are skeptical of that claim? Okay, and just think in your head, what does it mean to be easy to use? Right? Like FindBugs might be like, I can download it and run it, but if it doesn't give me anything useful, then it easily did something worthless? I'm not sure. And again, it's not to pick on FindBugs. It's just claims that they make, right? And then we have to ask, are these claims true and under what conditions? And under what context is the 50% claim true? That seems very specific, right? And then, if the tool finds bugs, are they actually important? Right? In other words, you have software, you have a bunch of claims about it, and you have to find out, you have to ask yourself, are these claims true, and what is the actual value of that claim? For example, one thing that always I find so odd about this claim. If it's really true that it finds bugs 50% of the time, couldn't you then, by definition, go fix that 50% of bugs, and then rerun the tool, and then it still finds, I don't know, that makes no sense. Okay. Do you get the idea? This may or may not have value as a tool, but people often claim software has value. And you can come up with all sorts of cases where that claim would exist. Okay, so that's the end of the first half of the first lecture. And so what we're going to do now is we have till 10, right? We're going to spend until 10, which how much time is that? Oh, perfect. Okay, that's great. We're going to spend until 10, and what we're going to do is we're going to break up into small teams at first, spend a few minutes here and there. We're going to try to start to derive research questions around impact, and I want to guide this discussion a bit. Okay? If we know that programming languages have a cost associated with them, then I want you to think of research questions related to those costs. For example, how many of you said scientific computing when we were talking first? So one thing that you might ask is, if we're paying scientists across a country at that level, how much does that cost and how much time do they spend doing scientific computing? That would be an example of a research question. Now that would just be documenting things. But you might also ask questions like, how much of that time is wasted? Right? Scientists are very expensive. Right? And more crucially, if as a country you want a competitive advantage, you want those scientists to be doing things that are productive, that actually help their research. And as such, you want that time to be of value. Right? So by definition, you might try to come up with research questions related to the value that is produced from a particular group you care about. Okay? If you care instead about children, maybe that's your interest. I didn't mean to imply people don't care about children. But, you know, sometimes in peer review, people claim things, right? It's only professionals that matter, or something. But if you care about younger people or the impact in the education system, maybe the research questions you come up with are related to the impact on the education system. That's okay, too. Those are just as valid questions. Totally legitimate. Or maybe you care about professionals in a certain context, right? Maybe you care about full-stack developers, right? Full-stack developers, you can find data on them. They actually have all sorts of weird things. For example, why is it the case that we write in HTML, then we use CSS for presentation? On the back end, we use PHP, and on the front end, we use JavaScript because of reasons, and then we connect into an SQL layer with 5 programming languages all at once. How on earth does that make sense? Right? Right? These things just kind of developed and we just accept them. But it's bonkers that we do. Maybe that kind of research question is relevant for you. I don't really know. But what I want to do for the next, let's say, 5 minutes, I want you to brainstorm as a small group again the kinds of questions you personally care about. You're not trying to debate like which questions are better. But what we're going to do, we're going to talk about them as small groups for a few minutes, and then I'm going to pull up a little sheet that I have, and we're going to start to write down all the questions that we're interested in. The purpose of this is so that we can all see the kinds of things we care about as a team, and if you're thinking about things like master's thesis documents, what kind of questions do we think that we find interesting? We're going to start by documenting them. And then later we'll start to prioritize them based on what we think their impact would be. If you've never done this before, this is a common thing to do. For example, if you review grants at the National Science Foundation, oftentimes you get a big list of grants. And then you rate them first on, like, are they valid, right? You know, like, is this actually science? But then once you do that, oftentimes at the NSF you have to ask these hard questions, like, if this grant succeeds, what impact will it have on society? And we'll be doing that kind of thinking as well, because that matters, right? Okay, so 5 minutes. Come figure out between you some research questions you think are interesting for you personally, and then we'll start to write them down. 5 minutes. Okay, and I do time these, so we don't go crazy. 5 minutes. By the way, I always walk around because I like to listen to the conversations, but I'll try not to interrupt you as an individual group. But if I'm, like, standing over, I'm not staring at you. I mean, or maybe I am, but, like, I'm not trying to be disturbing. I'm just trying to listen. Turns out people think it's more intuitive by 1/2 of a point by the time going 11-point metric scale for every year of use. So if you program your language for, let's just say, 9 years, keep that in the back of your head. That's right. Sure, I'm not judging, I'm just saying, I'm just dancing. Okay, 1.5 minutes. Okay, 20 seconds. All right, time. Okay, the next thing that we're going to do is before we do any discussion of these research questions, I want to go around the room and document them, right, so that we have a list. The purpose of this is to have something that we can all take away and say, this is what we came up with as a group for the kinds of research questions, given, you know, all of 45 minutes of discussion so far, from what we have so far, right? We'll change this over the course of the week, but that's the idea. So the way we're going to do it is round robin. So each group will have one research question, then we'll go to the next, and we'll just keep going around until we've sort of run out or we get bored. Once we've done that, we'll discuss them and try to figure out what we think are interesting or what we don't, right? When we're doing these round robins, let's have no discussion. The point is to document, not to discuss. Once we've documented, then we can start thinking about it critically, okay? So we'll start with you folks and just say one of the research questions that you had. Keep it short and concise if possible.
How to improve our means not to lose a lot of this information that we don't have in the end in our programming code. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I put, how do we improve our means to not lose information?
Not just mathematical model. It also can be a hypothesis or any other theoretical idea in different fields.
Okay. Your group.
They start with how costly in time-wise or money-wise it is to go into another language or group of languages like object-oriented or not.
This is classically called the transfer effect. Yep. And ironically, we just did a study measuring some of this, so we'll be able to talk about that. Okay. The transfer effect between 2 years of C++ and R is 3.4%. Virtually not. Weird. I'll explain. Yeah. Next. But that's a good question. It's of high relevance in the literature right now. So.
You were thinking about the slide with the different hello worlds. And like, is the initial like sort of simplicity in the syntax of the language really necessarily a good thing, like after you learn it?
Okay, that's a good question. Yeah. Now, did the next group, did you have another question?
No.
Okay. Go ahead.
We didn't either.
That was your only question? Okay. What about you folks?
Well, it was sort of about the skills learned in one language and transferring over, but I think it's the first question.
Okay, that's the second question then? You also had that? Okay. What about you folks? Did you have another?
Well, actually, our group did have one question. It was about children who had sure that there is children learns to program and are they actually interested and not to waste money on programming, but if a student is interested about something, are they forced to learn programming instead of something else which they might be better at? So how to make sure that children actually do benefit from the programming, which is actually now at schools.
So is that question represent what you're thinking, or no?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so is there any other research questions people want to toss up there as a starting point? Obviously, we've only done 45 minutes of talking so far, so it's not exactly a whole lot to go on, but Yeah.
What kind of language features increase productivity of professional programmers?
Oh, how does the... Okay. Does that capture it?
Kind of.
Kind of? Okay. Other questions? And it's okay to kind of just shout them out now. You do a group discussion to seed it, but if you have others, we can toss them up. I'll add one. What specific features of programming language? I said, what specific features of a program language cause ease of use? In other words, what's the cause? For whom and in what context? Do you have one, Adi Yohani?
Sure. I was thinking about, are there features in program languages that
like that?
Enable inequality. So, for example, sexism.
Oh, interesting. Inequality.
Yeah.
Huh.
Language.
Interesting.
Languages, yeah.
I had thought about that. That's a great question. Right, yeah. I don't know if it's true in Finland, but I know in the US, women are significantly underrepresented, clearly not in this class. Say what? Underrepresented. There's more men than women in computer science. Why? I don't think people really know for sure, but it's sort of weird, so it's possible. So, well, actually, that's what's weird. So in the U.S., there's a book by a woman named Jane Margolis called... Unlocking the Clubhouse, great author. Jane Margolis is a really fascinating woman if you've never heard of her. She works at UCLA. I actually met her at the White House. That's a long story. Never mind. And Jane wrote this book called Unlocking the Clubhouse, and she documented that actually in computer science, at least in the US, there were actually a ton of women, and then in the early 90s, it like dropped substantially. Why? I don't know. But like, there's some speculation as to why, like, changes in the media, changes in other stuff. No one really knows. But it dropped like through the floor and it's been slowly crawling back up since with like active effort on computer scientists' part, but nobody really knows for sure. So, in other words, it's varied over time, and so what's the cause of that variation is an interesting question. So.
What do you mean by dropped? There were like less people studying?
Mm-hmm. So like in the 80s, I don't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head, but I want to say 30-35%, then it dropped to like 20 or something like that. Very substantial drops. So you think about it like the proportion between 0 and 100, and it was at some point here, and then it went down because of some reason. So, well, it's hard to know for sure because these are effects that you observe over an entire society. So it's like, how do you knock that down to a cause is a really difficult research question. So people have been trying.
Go with mathematics as well, or just computer science?
Just computer science. In fact, mathematics, physics, and other disciplines, the number of women went up. So what?
I'm doubted that maybe other scientific fields were more attractive.
Yeah, it could be, but that's what people try to speculate about. But I'm saying I don't know the answer. So it's possible that there is one, but I'm unaware of one in the literature. So, yeah. Okay, any other questions that people have? Yeah?
How to make documentation of the programming languages easy to read? Yeah.
That's a great question. There is a little bit known. It turns out you want to embed examples, and there's some other stuff, but like... Okay, other Also, weirdly, static typing, if you have static typing and you have documentation, it raises your cover, it explains 14% of the variance. Anyway, I guess I'll get to that later. But other questions? Okay, I'm surprised nobody mentioned anything that's a specific debate. Have you heard of any debates in the language design space where people just disagree about things? For example, with specific features, have you ever heard someone claim a particular feature was good or bad before? I know I've heard it like a million times. For example, how many people have heard of lambdas? Okay, are they good or bad? Show of hands, good. Show of hands, bad. Show of hands, I don't really know. Okay, what about differences in syntax between languages? Does that matter? How many people say sure? How many people say definitely not? How many people say I'm still not sure? Okay, what about languages have differences in their semantics, right? Right, like they, you know, they might, Haskell might have some really funny mechanism. In fact, we all know it does, right? Well, maybe many of us do. Do those features matter? Like, did they invent them, but they make no difference? For example, how many people have heard of generics? This idea in Java or in other languages? Does that matter? There's actually quite a bit of data on this. What do you think? Yes? Who says yes? Who says no? They are stupid. How many people say, I don't really know, but I bet it's complicated? That's the right answer, by the way. It's very complicated. Okay. So, what I'm trying to get you to think about is there's a couple ways to look at this. One is you could just pit languages against each other, like Python versus C++, but actually that's not always that useful because these products, they're so varying, it's hard to know what to test. However, a lot of these products over time have developed specific features and language designers have made really specific claims about them. Like, I added lambdas to my language and that's good. When was that added to C++? Anybody know? C++ 11, so 2011-ish, right? Was it good or bad? What kind of testing do you think they did on it? Did they test with novices? How many people say they probably tested with novices? Professionals. How many people said, well, C++ is for professionals? They probably test with professionals. Right? Yeah? Okay. Now, C++ 11 added something like 1,000 features, right? Of those, assumingly they did a test on any of the ones that were important, that really mattered, that changed the language somewhat substantively, right? Because C++ is like this big, giant language, right? And it's used by companies all over the world. Like, it's a big deal if all of your developers are using it because that's expensive, right? So of that 1,000, how many people say they tested using some kind of science? Over 900 of them. Over 500 of them? Over 200 of them? How many people say that they tested at least one of their features? At least one? Okay, well, unfortunately, all of you are wrong. They tested none of them, which sounds bad and is, but think about that as a master's student. That means all of them are open questions in the literature, right? By definition, if they haven't been tested, that gives you an opportunity to go narrow the list. And it's not always easy to know which ones to choose. Some of them probably matter and some of them don't. On the other hand, if you're Microsoft and you've got all sorts of features that are costing you money, I bet you care. And they do absolutely care. For example, I know the TypeScript team over there is heavily invested. Same at Google. They've gone through tremendous effort to try to increase the productivity of their engineers because they're dealing with these archaic languages. So think about that a little bit. We'll talk about it more as we go. It's 9:56, so here's what I propose. Why don't we stop here for now, just after some discussion, after we had our discussion, and we will go on to our second lecture at...
I think 1.
Oh, 1. Okay, so we've got a 3-hour break.
Yeah. The question is, we have a tradition here, usually. When we say 1, it means 1:15, but we want to follow that here.
I say we go at 1, and then we can always take the 15 later.
So 1 is exact.
Yeah?
Yeah. Okay.
Is that cool? I don't really care either way. It doesn't matter to me. Okay, before we go and come back at 1, are there any questions? You kind of get where we're going? Like, I'm trying to kind of piecemeal out some data as you go and slowly build up what you know about in terms of, like, the data, what the evidence is, and also getting you to think that, like, there's a ton of open questions in this space for you to, like, pick on and grab. As students, a ton. I like to describe it as like as a master's student, you could like put all of it on a wall. You could throw a dart, hit a research question that was accidentally foundational for the field. It would probably be possible. So there's a lot of room in the literature. Just saying. Okay, let's take a break. We'll come back at 1 o'clock. Yeah.
One question.
Sure. I have a student that's doing that right now, actually. Yeah, it's fascinating. He's been studying polyglot programming and looking at data from how polyglots in natural language do stuff. But, so it's a rich area to explore. I don't claim to be an expert, though. So, yeah, definitely interesting, though.